Hello, good afternoon, and thank you for tuning in to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your host, Diana, here with you every Saturday to bring you the news and top stories from the Military Times, your independent news source about your military. All right, starting with the latest headlines, this one concerning veterans. Trump order would allow more VA research on medical marijuana. An executive order signed Thursday by President Donald Trump would reclassify marijuana as a controlled substance with potential medical use, a designation that will make it easier for the Department of Veterans Affairs to conduct research on cannabis's effectiveness for pain management, mental health conditions, and other symptoms. However, reclassifying cannabis from a Schedule 1 drug on par with heroin and ecstasy to a Schedule 3 substance in the same category as ketamine, steroids, and testosterone will not change the VA's policy that prohibits its doctors from prescribing medical cannabis. That would require a change in federal statute. Trump's executive order seeks to accelerate the process for the Justice Department to reschedule marijuana. In the order, Trump noted that DOJ issued a proposed rule last year to change marijuana's status and that the Department of Health and Human Services has determined that it has accepted medical use for some conditions. The National Institute on Drug Abuse and the Food and Drug Administration also have agreed that the drug should be rescheduled. It is the policy of my administration to increase medical marijuana and CBD research to better inform patients and doctors, Trump wrote. It is critical to close the gap between current medical marijuana and CBD use and medical knowledge of risks and benefits, including for specific populations and conditions. According to the VA, the department currently has 6 studies underway on medical marijuana and has completed 10 since 2010. Past studies have addressed the prevalence of use among veterans prescribed opioid medications, and cannabis use in relation to stress. Current studies are looking at its potential as a treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder, chronic pain, and more. 40 states and Washington, D.C. have regulated medical marijuana programs. But while veterans can access the medication in states where it is legal, department policy allows only for discussion about marijuana use between VA providers and patients. The VA is prohibited by federal law from prescribing it or covering its cost. VA Press Secretary Pete Kasperowitz said Thursday that the executive order will not change that law. Federal law prohibits VA from prescribing and/or recommending marijuana as a treatment option for patients, Kasperowitz said in a statement to Military Times. We are grateful for President Trump's executive order, which will make it easier for the department to conduct future medical studies involving marijuana. The House and Senate both approved legislation this year that would have allowed VA doctors to recommend medical marijuana for their patients, although those provisions were stripped from the law that ended the U.S. government shutdown. Several lawmakers, including Florida Republicans and veterans, Representative Brian Mast and Representative Gregory Stube, have introduced legislation that would ensure that veterans retain their benefits and full access to health care if they use medical marijuana under a state-sanctioned program. The VA's policies prohibit employees from denying vets their benefits because of marijuana use, and doctors can discuss its use with patients as part of comprehensive care. The lawmakers say their legislation is needed to ensure that veterans don't lose access to other medications if they use marijuana. Although the executive order does not change the law, the nation's largest veteran service organization, the American Legion, praised the order. This is really an important executive order, National Commander Dan Wiley said following the signing ceremony in the Oval Office on Thursday. Cannabis being classified Schedule 1 blocks large-scale randomized clinical trials examining cannabis, impact on PTSD, traumatic brain injury, sleep disruption, anxiety, depression, and chronic pain, conditions strongly associated with veteran suicide. Wiley added that the support does not mean the American Legion supports recreational use of cannabis. Reclassification is not legalization and does not mandate use, Wiley said. It simply removes federal barriers to research and informed decision-making. Supporting reclassification demonstrates the Legion's commitment to science, oversight, and saving lives through evidence-based public health policy. All right, now shifting gears a little bit to Pentagon and Congress, some news about them. The Pentagon fails the financial audit for the 8th year in a row. The Pentagon failed its financial audit for the 8th consecutive year, the Defense Department said Friday, highlighting the ongoing systemic challenge the nation's largest federal agency faces in fully accounting for its assets. The department has received a failing grade on every audit since Congress mandated annual reviews beginning in 2018, and is the only one of the government's 24 major agencies never to pass. In the Department of Defense Agency financial report for fiscal year 2025, auditors identified 26 material weaknesses and 2 significant deficiencies in the department's financial reporting. Among the shortcomings were omissions in the Joint Strike Fighter program, the Pentagon's multifaceted effort to develop an affordable strike aircraft for the Air Force, Marine Corps, Navy, and allied nations. Auditors determined the Pentagon failed to report assets in the program's global spares pool and did not accurately record the property. The DoD could not provide or obtain accurate and reliable data to verify the existence, completeness, or value of its global spares pool assets for the Joint Strike Fighter program, according to the report. As a result, the omission of the Joint Strike Fighter program global spares pool assets resulted in a material misstatement on the agency-wide financial statements. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said the department remains committed to annual financial audits and is actively conducting a comprehensive review of its budget. The Pentagon reported $4.65 trillion in assets and $4.7 trillion in liabilities located across all 50 states and more than 40 countries. The department cannot resolve decades of war, neglect of America's defense industrial base, and soaring national debt through unchecked spending, Hegseth said in a statement released with the audit. We are dedicated to openly sharing audit results and using them as a guide for continuous improvement. We believe this report clearly illustrates that progress and our unwavering dedication to ensuring every taxpayer dollar is used effectively and efficiently to strengthen our national defense. The department's chief financial officer, Jules Hurst, wrote in a letter concluded in the report that the Pentagon aims to resolve critical issues and achieve an unmodified audit opinion by 2028. All right, and this up next, some legal news about your military. A military lawyer was swiftly fired after defying Trump deportation push. A U.S. Army Reserve lawyer, detailed as a federal immigration judge, has been fired barely a month into the job after granting asylum at a high rate out of step with the Trump administration's mass deportation goals, the Associated Press has learned. Christopher Day began hearing cases in late October as a temporary judge at the immigration court in Annandale, Virginia. He was fired around December 2nd, the National Association of Immigration Judges confirmed. It's unclear why Day was fired. Day did not comment when contacted by the Associated Press, and a Justice Department spokeswoman declined to discuss personnel matters. But federal data from November shows he ruled on asylum cases in ways at odds with the Trump administration's stated goals. Of the just 11 cases he concluded in November, he granted asylum or some other type of relief allowing the migrant to remain in the United States a total of 6 times, according to federal data analyzed by Mobile Pathways, a San Francisco-based nonprofit. Such favorable outcomes for migrants have been increasingly rare, as the Trump administration seeks to slash a massive backlog of 3.1 million asylum cases by radically overhauling the nation's 75 immigration courts. As part of that drive, the Trump administration has fired almost 100 judges, viewed as too liberal and over, the summer eased rules allowing any attorney, regardless of their legal background, to apply to become what recent recruitment ads refer to as deportation judge. In response, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth in September approved sending up to 600 military lawyers to hear asylum cases. The goal, migrant advocacy groups say, is to redefine a judge's traditional duties as a fair, independent arbiter of asylum claims into something akin to a rubber stamp in a robe for the White House's mass deportation goals. The American Immigration Lawyers Association has decried the influx of military officers lacking expertise in immigration law, likening them to cardiologists attempting to do a hip replacement. But Pentagon and White House officials have defended the move, saying that a campaign to rule on pending asylum claims was something that all federal workers, as well as migrants sometimes in limbo for years, should rally behind. So far, only 30 members of the military have been detailed to the immigration courts, and for the most part appear to have lived up to the administration's expectations. 9 out of every 10 migrants whose asylum cases were heard by such judges in November were either ordered removed or requested to self-deport, according to federal data. Overall, the military judges ordered removal 78% of the time, compared to 63% for all other judges. But those like Day, whose rulings countered that trend, are especially vulnerable if it is determined they violated their military duties, said Dana Lee Marks, a retired immigration judge. It's hard to imagine someone being fired so quickly after 5 weeks on the bench, unless it was for ideological reasons, said Marks, the former head of the National Association of Immigration Judges. It's especially unfair to military judges because they don't have the same civil service protections and could face severe consequences for failing in their assignment. The Uniform Command of Military Justice, which governs service members, forbids senior military leaders from interfering or retaliating against military attorneys for their actions in a military tribunal. Army regulations also require JAG attorneys to proceed with candor and honesty, much like all licensed lawyers are expected to do in civil courts. But whether those standards apply to military lawyers working outside of the normal confines of a military tribunal is untested. Brenner Fissel, a Villanova University law professor, said that there are a number of personnel actions that can be taken, letters of counseling or reprimand, that even if found to be a baseless later, would affect one's potential for promotion and impact their discharge. Appealing such decisions, he said, is a Byzantine process that can take years and requires hiring a costly lawyer. The process can be the punishment, said Fissel, who helps run the Orders Project, which helps provide counsel to military personnel who believe they're being asked to carry out illegal orders. A graduate of American University Law School, Day has held multiple jobs in the federal government over the past two decades, while simultaneously serving as Lieutenant Colonel in the U.S. Army Reserve's Judge Advocate General Corps. His last job was as an attorney for the Federal Communications Commission during the Biden administration. Unlike federal judges who have lifetime tenure, immigration judges are employees of the Justice Department, which runs immigration courts and can be fired by the Attorney General with fewer restraints. That message was driven home during a two-week training course in October held for new judges, including those assigned by the Pentagon, according to someone who attended the training on the condition of anonymity to discuss the private sessions. The Pentagon has offered extra incentives to military officers signing up for temporary detail on immigration courts. Those volunteering were promised their choice of assignments, according to an email sent by the JAG Corps leadership in the fall. But if enough officers did not come forward, officers might be required to relocate up to 6 months away from home to fulfill the mandate, according to the email. All right, this up next. U.S. launches operation to eliminate ISIS fighters in Syria. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has announced the start of an operation to eliminate ISIS fighters' infrastructure and weapon sites in Syria, following the deaths of three U.S. citizens. Two Iowa National Guard members and a U.S. civilian interpreter were killed December 13th in an attack in the Syrian desert that the Trump administration has blamed on the Islamic State group. The slain National Guard members were among hundreds of U.S. troops deployed in eastern Syria as part of a coalition fighting the Islamic State. And the shooting attack by a gunman came as the U.S. military is expanding its cooperation with Syrian security forces. Syrian state television reported that strikes hit targets in rural areas of Deir ez-Zor and Raqqa provinces and in the Jabhat al-Amour area near Palmyra. It said they targeted weapons storage sites and headquarters used by ISIS as launching points for its operations in the region. The official who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive operations said more strikes should be expected. White House officials noted that Trump had made clear that retaliation was coming. President Trump told the world that the United States would retaliate for the killing of our heroes by ISIS in Syria, and he is delivering on that promise, White House Deputy Press Secretary Anna Kelly said in a statement. Trump this week met privately with the families of the slain Americans at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware before he joined top military officials and other dignitaries on the tarmac for the dignified transfer, a solemn and largely silent ritual honoring U.S. service members killed in action. The guardsmen killed in Syria on Saturday were Sergeant Edgar Brian Torres Tovar, 25, of Des Moines, and Sergeant William Nathaniel Howard, 29, of Marshalltown, according to the U.S. Army. Iyad Mansour Sakat of Macomb, Michigan, a U.S. civilian working as an interpreter, was also killed. The shooting, nearly a week ago, near the historic city of Palmyra, also wounded three other U.S. troops, as well as members of Syria's security forces, and the gunman was killed. The assailant had joined Syria's internal security forces as a base security guard 2 months ago, and recently was reassigned because of suspicions that he might be affiliated with ISIS, Interior Ministry spokesperson Nawar al-Din al-Baba has said. The man stormed a meeting between U.S. and Syrian security officials who were having lunch together and opened fire after clashing with Syrian guards. All right, and now this story, which comes to us from military service members. We pined for the comforts of home. We got socks for Christmas instead. This article first appeared on The War Horse, an award-winning nonprofit news organization educating the public on military service, under the headline, "We pined for the comforts of home. We got tube socks and old candy for Christmas instead." It started as a rumor, but like war stories, rumors tend to grow with the telling. And as deployment dragged on, the number of packages we were expecting doubled and doubled again, eventually reaching delirious heights that surpassed all reason. 100 care packages? Too high and too round a number, I thought. Clearly made up. A conversational exaggeration pulled out of someone's ass. These mythical parcels had supposedly been assembled by the very best of Front Porch America, real Norman Rockwell patriots of some down-home church group connected to one of the guys on my team through his wife's cousin's roommate or something. And when this church group heard that a team of Green Beret was deployed to the beige desolation of Iraq for 6 months, they put on a call for care packages, and the pious congregation had offered up a most goodly bounty. Not that we were desperate for material salvation. Deployment to Iraq in 2018 was like a government-funded Lawrence of Arabia summer camp. We lived at the biggest base in the country, next to the Baghdad airport, and far from anything going boom. We ate at Chow Hall with an omelet bar, slept in air-conditioned shipping containers converted into living spaces, and shopped at a small PX selling drinks and snacks. We even had a Green Beans coffee shop to supply us with mediocre lattes and a rec center where I played Settlers of Catan every week with doctors and nurses from the hospital. It was austere, but for a combat zone, it was five-star luxury. Besides the odd helicopter dropping off combat casualties, we felt distanced from the horrors and privations of war. Our biggest struggle was being away from our families and civilian careers, which as reservists, we'd taken leave from. Even a cush deployment means half a year away from birthdays, weddings, recitals, graduations, and a normal life. I had paused my plans for graduate school to become a physician assistant, which would require at least a year of post-baccalaureate coursework. I couldn't start from a combat zone with shaky Wi-Fi. My girlfriend and I abruptly ended our 5 years together over Skype, distance having made visible the irreparable cracks in our relationship. Everything was the color of dirty sand. The T-walls, the housing units, the dust on our vehicles, the days themselves which faded one into the next as we trained Iraqis who did not want to be trained and delivered them equipment they didn't know how to maintain. Our deployment felt like the war in miniature, a costly disruption with no clear intention and no end in sight. Care packages broke up the monotony and sometimes provided us with some useful things. Shortly before Christmas, my dad sent me a black folding pocket knife, utilitarian enough for everyday use, but sporting a point mean enough to ruin someone's day. Tucked in my right pocket, it went everywhere with me, whether I was flying on a helicopter or walking to the chow hall. A teammate happened to know the owner of a company that made flat caps, like those worn by golfers and old-school cabbies. That company surprised our team with a box of army green flat caps that matched our camo fatigues. We looked cool as hell. Exercising our special forces prerogative to flout army uniform regulations, we sported the caps as an unofficial uniform, raising our profile on base as well as our spirits. What I really needed, though, was a jacket. In packing for my first deployment, I didn't realize how chilly the desert would get. Some nights dropped as low as 40 degrees, and I foolishly had not packed anything warmer than a sweatshirt. I ordered a Patagonia jacket online and waited weeks, then months, for it to appear in the mailroom. I didn't expect any fashionable outerwear to come in the fabled hall of packages we've been told about, but speculating about what loot they might contain turned into a game at our morning meetings. Most of us were lifters and hoped for tubs of pre-workout and protein powder. The dip addicts crossed their fingers for logs of Copenhagen. All wished for bags of gourmet coffee, pouches of beef jerky, energy drinks, maybe even board games. A few weeks into the new year, they arrived. I discovered about 30 boxes stacked in the mail room addressed to us, and the mail sergeant informed me another 90 were on the way. 120! Even the rumored 100 had been a low ball. I piled them, all red, white, and blue priority mail boxes the size of a birthday cake, high in my dusty Suburban, texted the boys, and escorted the precious cargo over the bumpy dirt roads to our team room across base. And then, there we were at last. Green Beret circled like giddy children around a Christmas tree, each having selected one box from the pile and savoring those last moments of mystery before the riches were revealed. What we found under those box flaps defied all our expectations. Fun-sized Snickers and Milky Ways, decorated with jack-o'-lanterns, marking them as trick-or-treater rejects of 3 months prior, now grotesquely wrapped in their wrappers after melting in transit. Canned foods, hearty staples a hermit might select to line the concrete walls of a survivalist bunker. Beef stew, baked beans, creamed corn, dried ramen noodles, brittle in their orange plastic 5-packs and adorned with green circular 99-cent stickers no one had bothered to remove. The senders, as if anticipating gastrointestinal distress from this dollar store diet, thoughtfully included several rolls of toilet paper. And finally, in every box, there were exactly 3 pairs of bargain bin white tube socks. At first, the quiet was broken by a few quizzical chuckles as we pulled each item out of the boxes, which we soon realized were all packed with a depressing uniformity. Then the heavy silence of disbelief and shock. At last, my teammate said what we were all thinking. What the fuck? Do they think we're deployed or homeless? Our gratitude was displaced by secondhand embarrassment, like hearing a badly delivered joke. The well-meaning rubes assembling these packages apparently envisioned us as refugees fleeing some unspeakable calamity that had left us starving, barefoot, and without means to wipe ourselves, rather than residing at a sprawling, well-appointed manifestation of the 21st century military-industrial complex, complete with running water, indoor plumbing, and a dining hall serving 3 kinds of cake. There were comforts of home that we pined for, but they sure as hell were not cheap socks and toilet paper. Each box struck me as physical manifestation of thank you for your service, a gesture of appreciation nice enough on the outside, but empty of substance. Missing from the packages was also what's missing in thank you for your service. Minimal effort to understand the challenges that people in the military face. And without understanding, you can't show genuine empathy. Instead, you get performative patriotism and 100 boxes of things normally collected for homeless shelters. If those citizens had simply asked any Operation Iraqi Freedom, Operation Enduring Freedom veteran in their town, or even online, what soldiers on deployment need, they could have spent a fraction of the money on things we could have used, like a tub of pre-workout powder, a single bag of gourmet coffee, or in my case, a light jacket. It was unsettling to learn that many civilians apparently have no grasp of the military-industrial behemoth their own taxes are funding. Like shipping ice cubes to Antarctica, these fellow citizens had sent us dried ramen and TP, while untold millions of their tax dollars were providing us with flush toilets and hot meals on a fully developed base established there over a decade ago. So these people not only didn't get our individual needs as soldiers, they were voting taxpayers with no comprehension of the resources given to us by the officials they elected and the defense budget they funded. The boxes kept coming, multiplying like dividing cells. Soon our team room resembled a USPS distribution center, red, white, and blue boxes stacked up the walls. We'd crack one or two in each batch to make sure the contents didn't vary, and they never did. Always the same cheap socks, the same beef stew, the same melted candies. In the end, we did what our government had so effectively taught us to do. We gave it all to the Iraqis. The whole damn pile. Waste disposal disguised as international aid. We loaded up a truck, drove outside the wire and across the street to the Iraqi base, piled all 120 boxes in an orderly tower on a dusty concrete floor between crates of expired tourniquets and cast-off camo fatigues, as if these TP rolls, socks, and canned goods were part of the grand U.S. strategy all along, and walked away. And for all I know, they could still be there, stacked neatly in a dark Iraqi warehouse, boxes we didn't need, re-gifted to others in the same unsolicited way they'd been bestowed on us. No one bothered to ask the Iraqis if they liked creamed corn. Well, that's all the time we have. Thank you once again for tuning in to Sun Sounds of Arizona and listening to this segment of the Military Times. This is your host, Diana, signing out.